For thousands of years, men and women, of course, have lived in cities, villages, towns, and there's been travel through different places from town to town and village to village, and there's been usually a place that you could stay at that was away from your home. If you had a tent, you brought it. A lot of times you couldn't have a tent, so you had in places like United States, Britain, or Europe, you had a place called an inn, and you could stay at that inn temporarily. For a coin, you could give the innkeeper the chance to wake you up in the morning, and maybe you had a stagecoach to catch, or a ship, or, I don't know, some reason to get up in an hour you were afraid that you might miss. So this was basically a courtesy that they could do for you. And nowadays, you can also do the same thing. You go stay at a hotel, and you can ask the desk clerk or the front desk to give you a call on the phone. This is also a courtesy call, but I'd like to call it what a term that is it's been more well known for, and that, of course, is a wake-up call. And so that's the title of my message, if you would like to know the title. So today we're going to look at the concept of a courtesy call, or what it's better known as a wake-up call, and what it means to us in this hour that we're living in. We will look at what our responsibilities are to a wake-up call, and we're going to look at a few biblical examples of wake-up calls. So to start with, let's look at some definitions of the term wake-up call. A telephone call made according to prior arrangement to wake the person called, like we just discussed. Two, a person or thing that causes people to become fully alert to an unsatisfactory situation and to take action to remedy it. Three, something that alerts a person to a problem or danger. By this definition, we receive wake-up calls our entire life, both physically and spiritually. So let's look at physical wake-up calls to set the stage at first, and then we're going to look at spiritual wake-up calls, because after all, we're here at church, and this is the time to be focused on the spiritual things. So physical. Physically, we think we're fine. We're basically devoting little or no attention to our health. We go in and give blood, for example, and they tell us, hey, you have blood pressure that's basically you're either going to have a heart attack or a stroke imminently, and you need to sit down, and we're going to take you to the ER immediately. Well, 5 minutes before, you thought everything was fine, but you've just had a wake-up call, right? So this wake-up call then is saying you need to change direction, you need to do something differently. Another physical example, perhaps you get pneumonia, you go into the hospital, and they take your blood, right? They're going to do blood work on you, and they come back and tell you, hey, you've got type 2 diabetes. Now, 5 minutes before, you had no idea that you had any issue at all metabolizing sugar. And suddenly, you've got now something, an imminent threat that you have to address. You've been given a wake-up call. It could be anything else. It could be any kind of a other health issue that is a setback to you but doesn't take your life. It's unexpected. It affects you so much that you do make a major change. You value your life, and now you value your health. And so you change your habits to support that continued time on the earth. So there's a saying that you can give a little attention daily to your health every day, or you can ignore it, and it will eventually demand all of your attention and plenty of your money to correct what is now upon you. So sometimes health issues are wake-up calls. They say that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but it's really our responses to those circumstances that we need to manage and that will make the difference. So let's look at the main focus that we're here for, and that is the spiritual wake-up calls. That's where we're going. Let's look at a wake-up call that went well. Go to Book of Jonah with me, please. Short book, only four chapters. First chapter deals with him being swallowed by the fish, and the second one is just his experiences with the great fish. And it's the third chapter that I want to focus on. It's really the meat and potatoes of the lesson to learn from the book of Jonah, is chapter 3. Verse 1, now the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I tell you. So Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of the Lord. Now Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, a three-day journey in extent. And Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. Then he cried out and said, yet 40 days and Nineveh shall be overthrown. Fairly subtle here, what it says here. He cried out and said, yet 40 days. They don't go into any big elaboration here in this depiction of what happened. Now, they had a choice. They were given a wake-up call. He was a strange man. He was from another country. He smelled like something a fish ate. And I'm sure they had reason to doubt this fellow. Or they could heed the wake-up call and they could actually change their destiny by listening to this strange man. One movie once said, they chose wisely. So these people chose wisely. And of course, their king led the way as well. So they all turned from their ways. In fact, we can drop down to verse 10 and see what happened here. Then God saw their works, that they turned from their evil way, and God relented from the disaster that he had said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. They listened to the wake-up call. Let's look at some more biblical wake-up calls. Genesis 19. This wake-up call both went well and didn't go well, depending on who you were. Genesis 19, starting in verse 12. Then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place. For we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord. And the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. It's a wake-up call. Get out. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. They didn't listen. When the morning dawned, so this is right at sunup, right at the crack of dawn, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand. They had to drag him out. They took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters. They took them and pulled them out, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. So it came to pass, when they had brought them outside, that he said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. They told him to go to the mountains. Lot didn't want to go to the mountains. I have a feeling he didn't think he could make the trip. Then Lot said to them, please, no, my lords, indeed now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me, and I die. See, now this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said to him, see, I have favored you concerning this thing, in that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. So we're still here in the morning. It wasn't all that long later, which implies that it wasn't all that far away. The sun had risen upon the earth. Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. Lot took action. Lot listened to the wake-up call, and he did take action. Let's look at 2 Peter. The New Testament speaks to this as well. 2 Peter, we're going to look at chapter 2 and verse 6. And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. So there was definitely a lesson for people afterward. And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed with the filthy conduct of the wicked. He was oppressed with their conduct. For that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. I have the New King James. Other versions have vexed. So he was vexed by what he saw around him. So for them, for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, this was their doomsday. Whatever sort of warning that Lot gave them, they did not heed it. But Lot heeded it. Let's look at Isaiah, chapter 1. We're going to pick it up in verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. The ox knows its owner, and the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people do not consider. Alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a brood of evildoers, children who are corrupted, for they have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked the Lord to anger. The Holy One of Israel they have turned away backward. Verse 7. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. We've seen a lot of that lately. Strangers devour your land in your presence, and it is desolate and overthrown by strangers. Unless the Lord of hosts had left to us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been made like Gomorrah. We would have been destroyed completely, obviously. Verse 16. Wash yourselves and make yourselves clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Reprove the oppressor. Defend the fatherless. Plead for the widow. Verse 20. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. This is a very, very stern warning. Let's look at Jeremiah. Jeremiah 23. See another warning. In verse 14 of Jeremiah 23, also I have seen a horrible thing in the prophets, or the leaders. These were the leaders of Jerusalem. They commit adultery and walk in lies. They also strengthen the hands of the evildoers. Again, another thing that we've seen lately, strengthening the hand of the evildoers. So that no one turns back from all of his wickedness. All of them are like Sodom and Gomorrah to me. Sodom to me and her inhabitants like Gomorrah. In other words, these people that are strengthening the hands of the evildoers are to be wiped out. That's what God says. Let's go to verse 18, same chapter. For who has stood in the counsel of the Lord and has perceived and heard his word? Who has marked his word and heard it? Behold, a whirlwind of the Lord has gone forth in fury, a violent whirlwind. It will fall violently on the head of the wicked. The anger of the Lord will not turn back until he has executed and performed the thoughts of his heart. In the latter days, you will understand it perfectly. Let's go to Amos. Amos 4. It's kind of buried here in the minor prophets, a little hard to find sometimes. Verse 10 of Amos 4. I sent among you a plague after the manner of Egypt. Your young men I killed with a sword, along with your captive horses. I made the stench of your camps come up into your nostrils, yet you have not returned to me, says the Lord. I overthrew some of you, as God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah, and you were like a firebrand plucked from the burning, yet you have not returned to me. Therefore, thus will I do to you, O Israel, and because I will do this to you, prepare to meet your God, O Israel. Very stern warning once again. Wake up, Israel. For behold, he who forms mountains and creates the wind, who declares to man what his thought is and makes the morning darkness, who treads the high places of the earth, the Lord God of hosts is his name. We'll look at one more of these briefly in Ezekiel 33. Verse 9. Nevertheless, if you warn the wicked to turn from his way, and he does not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity. But you have delivered your soul. Therefore you, O son of man, say to the house of Israel, thus you say, if our transgressions and our sins lie upon us, and we pine away in them, how can we then live? Verse 28. For I will make the land most desolate, her arrogant strength shall cease. Verse 29. Then they shall know that I am the Lord when I have made the land most desolate because of all their abominations where they have committed. Again, these were wake-up calls for ancient Israel. But what about modern-day Israel? Two events stand out to me as wake-up calls to modern-day Israel. And I'm referring to one that happened in 1941 on December 7th. Our fleet in Hawaii was attacked by the forces of Japan on December 7th, and as Roosevelt described it, a day which would live in infamy, and it was also a wake-up call to a sleeping giant. I think it was probably a wake-up call that Europe wanted. They wanted us to get into the war and help them, but it was certainly taken by Americans as a wake-up call. Another one, of course, in relatively recent history was September 11th, 2001. Again, we were surprised by what happened. Everyone was in shock. And I remember definitely for so many Americans, they considered it a wake-up call back then. I would like to read for you just little excerpts from a poll that was recently taken by a group called the Joshua Fund. This poll was taken March 23rd. Through March 26. So, I mean, if you think back to when all of this started, the last time we met together was March 7th, before we were not meeting together for months. And ironically enough, there was a message that day about this coronavirus, and then we didn't meet together for a long time. So we last met in about 3 weeks later, and if you remember how quiet everything was, I mean, literally the freeways were empty. You know, a chicken could cross the road and get all the way across I-5 without any trouble. You know, I mean, it was easy to drive places for a while, for a few weeks. But this poll was taken only 2 or 3 weeks later, and this was back in March, and here we're now August 1st. So this was a while ago. And they asked people, do you think that this current crisis is a wake-up call? They put this out as a poll to 1,000 Americans. It was conducted by McLaughlin and Associates. They're a nationally respected polling company. So they asked the question, do you see the global pandemic and economic meltdown as a coming judgment, a wake-up call, or both? 44% said yes. I just wonder how different those numbers are now that it's kind of extended as long as it has. 47% said it has nothing to do with God or prophecy. Now, they started breaking it down into non-Christian respondents and Christian respondents, or people that identify as Christian respondents. Non-Christian respondents, they fully 1 in 5, 21% polled, said that the crisis is causing them to start to read the Bible and listen to Bible teaching and Christian sermons online, even though they don't usually. It's causing them to learn more about Bible prophecy and God's plan for the future of mankind, and have more spiritual conversations with family and friends. So for those that did not consider them Christians before, suddenly there's a percentage of them that are now saying, I need to look into this. Of Christian respondents, 4 in 10 self-identified Christians, they said they're reading the Bible more than ever, and they're watching and listening to Bible teaching and Christian sermons online since they can't go to church, and searching online to understand Bible prophecy and God's plan for the future of mankind. Another question, do you believe the pandemic and meltdown are evidence of what the Bible calls the last days? Nearly 3 in 10 Americans polled believe that the coronavirus and meltdown signs are that we are living in the last days. 56% said no, they don't. They don't believe it. Now, again, a lot has happened since this poll was taken in March. We've had uncontrolled riots. We didn't have them then when this was taken. We've had lawlessness. We've had cities burning, months of shutdowns. It was supposed to be only for 2 weeks. Now, I brought with me the most recent Beyond Today, it's the July-August issue. We got it back on the 7th of July. There was an article in here. I don't know if you read it. Darris McNeely wrote this, and I'm not going to read the whole article, but I am going to quote it because I found something quite intriguing in here, an analogy that he made, a connection that I had never made. The title of the article is, Will You Be Prepared for the Next Crisis? Subtitle is, The COVID-19 Pandemic and Recent Riots and Unrest Have Been Wake-Up Calls for Our World. Will You Be Prepared for the Next Crisis? On the second page of it, the title is, A World Transformed in Just 1 Month. And we're going to get to it. He makes a connection here with Hosea. What the world lived through within the space of about 1 month was a massive collapse of a prosperous economy. The United States was at nearly full employment. The stock market Dow Jones Industrial Average had rocketed to over 28,000 points. And the economy was producing higher wages and an improved living standard of living. The global economy, the train being pulled by the powerful U.S. economy, was also doing well. The biblical prophet Hosea, prophesying in the time of the ancient kingdom of Israel before its destruction, describes how quickly a nation could collapse because of its sins against God. When they try to seek God during a period of national crisis, Hosea said, He is not to be found. Why? They have dealt treacherously with the Lord, for they have begotten pagan children. Now a new moon shall deliver them and their heritage. This is Hosea 5:7. What does this mention of a new moon mean? The prophet Hosea foretold that within just 1 month, a lunar cycle averaging just under 30 days, a catastrophic collapse can occur. While recent events are not a direct fulfillment of Hosea's prophecy, such rapid change happened in March of 2020. Within a month, trillions of dollars of wealth disappeared and a prosperous economy seized up. You might all also remember back that at the beginning of the year, the front page of Beyond Today was, Are you ready for the 2020s or are you ready for 2020? And pretty much, I don't think anybody in the world was ready for what happened here this year. What should we do to become ready? What should we do? Luke 21. Let's go to Luke 21. Verse 34, Luke 21. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. For it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. Watch therefore, pray always, that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. Let's go to Romans 13. In verse 11, Do this, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep. It's your wake-up call now. For now our salvation is nearer than we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in licentiousness and lewdness, not in strife and envy. All right, so this is what we can do. What are we watching for? Is there something that we can be watching for? There certainly is. Matthew 24. Matthew 24. Pick it up in verse 4. And Jesus answered them and said to them, Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise up against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. We're going to come back to this chapter here in a little bit, so if you want to save your place. From February of 2012 through August 2014, there was a show that ran on National Geographic. It was their number one rated show. It lasted four seasons. And if you remember 2012 and what was happening in the consciousness of the world, a lot of people were basing upon the Mayan prophecies that the world was going to end in December of that year. Obviously, that was 8 years ago, and we're still here. But it prompted a lot of people to think, well, I'm going to prepare for the end of the world. So they had a show. It was called Doomsday Preppers. It was very popular. Like I said, it was their number one show, but it generally cast people preparing for the end of the world in a kind of a negative, kooky light. And since then, anyone who prepares has been called a prepper. It's really just a contraction of the word preparer. And it's almost become a term of derision. But all of those people that are casting derision upon people making any sort of preparations have a common ancestor. Their common ancestor was, in fact, the ultimate doomsday prepper. And all of us in this room actually share that same common ancestor. So let's look at a man who spent over 100 years of his life preparing for doomsday. Genesis 6. Genesis 6:11, the earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch." And he goes on to give the blueprints of how to build this craft. So he basically gave a wake-up call to Lot to prepare so that God could save his family through these bad times that were coming. I know a lot of you collect pictures of Noah's Ark. So many beautiful depictions of it. Usually there's the ship there in various shapes. But there's always the group of animals, the giraffes, the elephants, zebras, walking towards the ark. And that's our thought, basically, when we think of this time that was going on. And it's a very beautiful depiction of God's promises and God's faithfulness to us. Wonderful thing to think about. But I think in a lot of ways, when we think of Noah's Ark, we might just miss perhaps some of the most important part of it that we could actually focus on and change our lives by looking at this example. Let's go to 2 Peter. We were just there earlier looking at Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to go back to 2 Peter 2. Not only did it speak of Sodom and Gomorrah, but the verse before the Sodom and Gomorrah verse, it spoke about Noah. We read verse 6 and 7, I think, and we're going to look at verse 5, 2 Peter 2. "And did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people." And here's where we start getting into the character of Noah, "a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly." Noah was a preacher of righteousness. It's a very, very powerful reminder for us. Let's turn just a little bit back here. Let's see. A couple pages back, I think it is. 1 Peter. 1 Peter 3 has even a little bit more about Noah. 1 Peter 3:20. "Who who formerly were disobedient when once the long-suffering of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. So God was patient through that time, over 100 years. He saw all of what was going on, and he was long-suffering through this. And you know that he was, if Noah was vexed, God was most certainly vexed through all of it, enough clearly to wipe out the whole world. Let's go back to Matthew 24. I told you we were going to go back there. Matthew 24, and this time, rather than the beginning of that chapter, we're going to go a bit farther into it in verse 36. But of that day and hour, no one knows. No, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. Is there anyone here that doubts we're living in the last days? So what are the lessons from Noah? He was a righteous man in a world of evil, wasn't he? And he was a man of faith. So much so that he was included in the faith chapter as well. Is this current situation a wake-up call? Did we already go to Hebrews 11? Did we already go there? Let's go there. Let's go to Hebrews 11 real quick. Here's the other thing we can get from the lesson we can get from Noah. Hebrews 11:7. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So he was a man of righteousness, and he was a man of faith. So, I asked you already, is this current situation a wake-up call for the United States or for us as individuals? Do we need to make a change to save our lives? Do we need to make a change like a wake-up call would do? That's what a wake-up call is. It's a call to action. It's not a call to hit the snooze button. So, what's the final takeaway for today's journey into the subject of wake-up calls? Ephesians 5:16 tells us to redeem the time. Right? We are to redeem the time. And Isaiah 55:6 tells us to seek the Lord while he may be found. Noah did it. Noah was counted worthy to make the craft and continue on the human race. He prepared for the coming disaster and was considered by God to be a man of faith. Now, I'm not advocating anybody here. I'm not certainly going to run down to Home Depot and get 6 trainloads of gopher wood. So, what I'm talking about here is the spiritual things that we can take from here, not necessarily saying that we need to do what we can't do physically. It's always prudent to do things physically as you can. But what we're looking for here is the spiritual lessons that we can get from Noah and from all of the prophets that we read about earlier. Let's be like Noah, that God may say, here. Here's a righteous person. Let's remember and never forget the "and we know" scripture. And we know, Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his promise.